Online at with.n.
The Straz Center presenting the Broadway musical Fun Home, based on Alison Bechdel's graphic memoir, Fun Home. This musical takes a look at one's parents through grown-up eyes. November 28th through December 3rd. More information at strazcenter.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, an interview with one of the state's leading environmental reporters. We'll talk with him in a moment. But first, two listener comments. One about last Wednesday when we opened up the show for calls from listeners. And here's what one listener said about that.
Regarding the show you broadcast today on Radioactivity, I'd like to make a request, Rob, if you consider once a month, minimum once a month, to have this format. For only caller call-ins. Next, you and some guests were mentioning communes. There's another version of that that some people might have heard of. It's used in Europe, North Canada, United States, and Israel. They're called co-ops, and there's different versions of co-ops. There's ones for families that live together, extended families. There's also business co-ops. Maybe you'd look into doing a show on both of those are two separate ones. I recall the northeast of the United States, there was, I think, a coffee roastering shop. That was a business co-op. Of course, one person came forward with the capital, and then after that, everybody owed one share. There's also co-ops for living. There's many of them in the northwest, Oregon, Washington State, different provinces of Canada and Europe. And also in Israel, there's kibbutz. There's co-ops that are versions of kibbutzes and moshavs, where they're a combination of both. People live together and also work together and share all their income. Some are successful, some aren't, just like businesses in the United States, Borders Bookstore, Circuit City. Some businesses are successful, some aren't. Then the last thing, if you would consider, Rob, prior to your shows, day before, if you would post on your blog, Twitter or Facebook or the WMNF website blog, what the format is going to be for that day. So maybe we could post our questions the day before that you could ask the guests, because often when you have guests on, sometimes they're recorded earlier, or we don't get the time if they're live to bring our questions in.
And we got a listener comment last Friday about President Trump saying that the F-35 was invisible and had performed incredibly well in flights. So the F-35, the newest military fighter jet that the U.S. is producing, it has yet to fly operationally. Here's what one listener had to say following the discussion about what President Trump said about the F-35.
Hey, Rob. This is Skip Parrish. You and I have talked before, but I worked for the government, so I didn't let you use my name. But on the F-35, the Russians can see on L-band and X-band radar, they can see the F-35. I'm a subject matter expert on Russian electronic warfare for our military. We waited too long to bring it out, to develop it, and Trump is, I don't know how to educate him. That's a problem.
Some listener comments that came in over the last few days. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Coming up, we're going to talk with one of the state's leading environmental reporters about his new book about the strange history of Florida. We'll talk about some environmental issues as well. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we'll hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. Coming up next, for people who like to combine humor and history, have we got a show for you. It's all about the strange state of Florida. NASCAR, Betty Page, pinups, Glenn Beck, Stand Your Ground all got their start here in Florida. Our guest is Craig Pittman, and we'll talk with him about our eccentric state and his latest book, Oh Florida, coming up next on Florida This Week.
WEDU Studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. Craig Pittman is an author, an environmental reporter for the Tampa Bay Times, and a native Floridian. His family first settled here in the 1850s. Born in Pensacola, he graduated from Troy State University in Alabama, where his muckraking work for the student paper prompted an agitated dean to label him the most destructive force on campus. Since then, he's covered a variety of newspaper beats and quite a few natural disasters, including hurricanes, wildfires, and the Florida legislature. Since 1998, he's covered environmental issues for Florida's largest newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times. He's won the Waldo Prophet Award for Distinguished Environmental Journalism in Florida four times and twice won the Top Investigative Reporting Award from the Society of Environmental Journalists. In 2015, he and a fellow Times reporter shared the Integrity Florida Award for Public Corruption Reporting from the South Florida chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. And he's the author or co-author of four books: Paving Paradise, Florida's Vanishing Wetlands, and The Failure of No Net Loss, Manatee Insanity, Inside the War Over Florida's Most Famous Endangered Species, The Scent of Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and The World's Most Beautiful Orchid, which won the Silver Medal for Florida Nonfiction from the Florida Book Awards. And Oh, Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country, a New York Times bestseller, which won the gold medal for Florida Nonfiction from the Florida Book Awards. The book explains how America's weirdest state influences the rest of the country. He lives in St. Petersburg with his wife and two children. And Craig, welcome to WEDU. Great to see you.
Thanks for letting me be here.
So let me start by saying you postulate that Florida is out to kill you. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. Florida is the place that we have the most sinkholes of any state in America. We get more lightning than anywhere else in the Western Hemisphere. We are the shark bite capital of the world, I suppose because we taste so good. We get hit by more hurricanes than any other state. We're the most vulnerable to climate change because we're so flat and we're surrounded on three sides by water. And, of course, they had that creepy clown college down in Sarasota. So we put all those things together, and clearly Florida is out to get us. And yet we call it paradise and tell people, come on down and come join us here.
And yet so many people do come down here, 1,000 people a day. Why do they keep coming, do you think?
Because we lie to them. We tell them how wonderful it is and, you know, never mind all that other stuff. And we paint this glowing picture. And don't get me wrong, Florida's a beautiful state. I love living here. I wouldn't live anywhere else. I mean, we've got these, you know, cotton candy sunsets. We've got gorgeous beaches. We've got an award-winning state park system with all kinds of rivers and springs and so forth that you can go out and paddle on. And we've also got, you know, we're number one in identity theft and mortgage fraud and that other stuff, too. So you kind of have to weigh those two things. And to me, it's worth living here because it's also the most interesting state, too.
Well, you've got your book is filled with stories. Among the stories, the hucksters that tried to draw people to Florida. How far back does the hucksterism go to try to lure unsuspecting people from other parts of the country or the world to come here?
Well, I mean, we were, even before we were a state, we were known as a rogue's paradise. One of the first visitors here wrote that he thought half the people who lived in Florida were crooks and con men, and the other half were their penniless victims. So, you know, not much has changed. But the first time you see people really pushing a real estate scam is in like the 1915 era, which I think is around the time they came up with the term, you know, if you believe that, I got some swamp land to sell you. Mm-hmm. Where they actually had people selling land that was underwater and was never going to be anywhere else. In one of the subsequent trials, after indictments came down about that, one of the farmers who had, Midwestern farmer who had bought some Florida land and then discovered it was still underwater, he said, you know, I've bought land by the foot and land by the mile, but I've never bought land by the gallon before.
Florida got quite a reputation. The Marx Brothers made fun of us in their first film.
Coconuts,
right?
Yes.
So it wasn't just one guy. Dickie Bowles, I think, was the person from 1915. But it was dozens and dozens of people that were selling worthless land here in the 20s, 30s, even in the 50s.
Yes, absolutely. Fast buck artists have always come to Florida. They've always flocked here. The classic example to me is Carlo Ponzi, the guy who invented the Ponzi scheme. He created this wonderful criminal enterprise up in Boston, got caught. He's out on bail. Where does he go? He comes to Florida and gets involved in a real estate fraud. You know, he's selling people land that he says is really close to a town that doesn't exist, and he's selling it in odd increments. It's just a classic thing. So people who screw up elsewhere with the law come here to start over. People who basically see this as a place where they can grab for the gusto, they come here. And so we attract an awful lot of folks who are just in it for the money and in it for living for today. And that's, I think, creates a certain amount of the culture that we have here.
The land scammers weren't the only ones making money. Newspapers made money because...
Oh, sure.
Talk about how heavy newspapers were in the 20s.
In the 1920s, there were so many real estate ads that I think it was the Miami Herald, set a record that has never been broken for the number of pages in one newspaper because of all the real estate ads. One lady joked that she was going to subscribe to the Sunday paper, but she was afraid it would fall over and kill her.
Banks were involved?
Yes, yes. The banks were involved. They had the rules set up then, and they had a very, very accommodating regulator, a guy named Amos, who I like to call infamous Amos, who made it very easy to set up bank charters. And so a lot of developers would set up their own banks, make loans to themselves, make loans to politicians. They wanted to buy off loans that never had to be paid back. Amos got quite a few of those. When they started failing, you know, it just was like dominoes.
Well, I imagine over time, people realized they were being scammed or flew down or took the train down to look at the land that they had bought, realized it was swampland, and turned their backs on Florida and said, I'm never going to get involved in a Florida land deal again.
And yet, over and over again, that's been our cycle. We go through the cycle of boom and bust over and over again where, you know, the land prices go sky high and then suddenly tumble down like Icarus, getting too high, too close to the sun. And a lot of that is because people see the prices going up and they just assume it's going to continue going up forever. And obviously it does not.
In your book, you point out all the interesting characters that got their start here. Betty Page, the pinup woman.
Yes.
Talk about her for a moment.
She had a career in sort of underground films for a while and was not a big name. And then she came to Florida on vacation and met a photographer named Bunny Yeager. Bunny had been a pinup model herself. Bunny figured out that she could make a lot more money behind the camera than in front of it. And plus, she sewed her own outfits. So she dressed up Bunny in a jungle woman outfit, took her out to a theme park, like a Lion Country safari type place, posed her in amongst all the cheetahs and jaguars and everything, you know, had her swinging out of a tree with a knife in her mouth and took those pictures and started her on her road to stardom. And also took a picture, Betty told her, I love to sunbathe. I sunbathe even in the nude so I don't have any tan lines. And so Bunny took advantage of that and took a picture of her that sold to a very young magazine known as Playboy.
Mm.
And it was just in time for Christmas. She was wearing a Santa hat and nothing else.
And she's become a cult figure ever since.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks to a Florida photographer.
All right, so this is a hotbed, I don't know why, but for conservative media, too. Glenn Beck,
yes.
Rush Limbaugh, the Drudge Report. We have a lot of conservative media. Why does Florida attract all these types?
In the case of Rush Limbaugh, he was living in New York. He wanted to be part of the media elite there, and he just couldn't break in. He couldn't get past the velvet rope. And people he bumped into on the street, most of them didn't know who he was, and the ones who did sneered at him. And he comes to Florida and discovers that a lot of people knew who he was and liked his message, he could become the media elite sort of by himself with the amount of money he had, and also that that there was no the tax structure here was much more amenable to the way he liked to live, and he could drive his very fancy car just as fast as he wanted anywhere he wanted, as opposed to New York where you kind of have to park your car and walk. So he thought this was terrific. He's lived here since 1996, and the only kind of blip is when he got arrested for the prescription drug problem that he developed while he was here. So, him moving here attracted others. Ann Coulter was living in Palm Beach. As you mentioned, Matt Drudge is down in the sort of Kendall area near Miami. So many that the New York Times dubbed that area the Right Coast. Newsmax, for instance, is also in that area.
Glenn Beck got his start, a big start in Tampa.
In Tampa, that's right, doing talk radio here. He was just another DJ, and he started doing talk radio, and it took off. And he got his contract renewed for some more time to go on the air and rant.
Because of our strange weather patterns here, weather forecasting got its start here in Florida, according to your book.
Well, hurricane forecasting really got its start. And you can see why. I mean, clearly hurricanes are a big deal here. Originally, hurricane forecasting was being done out of Washington, and it was just, it was terrible. You know, the quality of it was awful. And so they decided to break that up and separate it into the states, and they put one in Jacksonville, and eventually it moved down to Miami during World War II to take advantage of the use of radar. And it's been there ever since, and clearly has been making a big difference in people's lives. In fact, one of the directors of the National Hurricane Center, working with a local engineer in Miami, created the Saffir-Simpson scale that we all use to talk about the intensity of a hurricane, category one through five.
But Prohibition plays a big part in your book.
Yes.
Why was this a place where the laws of Prohibition were ignored?
A couple of reasons. One is our geography, where we have lots of places where you can bring in illegal things and not get noticed. You know, lots of little coves, little entry points for waterway delivery. And then the other thing, too, is it was popular with the tourists, and we do anything for tourists. And so there were reports that a lot of the local law enforcement would be totally gung-ho on Prohibition when it wasn't tourist season, and then when the tourists were here, they'd just look the other way, or sometimes even go along and make sure that the deliveries got made and weren't interrupted by anybody trying to rob the bootleggers.
Florida was wide open to organized crime, so much so that the Kefauver Commission in the 1950s came down and was trying to figure out what was going on here. Why was organized crime so big down here?
Well, gambling. Gambling was very popular with the tourists as well, so you got the illegal alcohol that sort of set it up in the 20s and got it going. And then and also there was Bolita, which was a very popular game starting in Ybor City. It had come from Cuba, and it spread from Ybor City across the state. And so you had a lot of people playing Bolita, and also there were a lot of slot machines. That was the big thing up in the Panhandle in particular. So the mob came in, pushed out the mom-and-pop operations, pushed out local operators like Charlie Wall, who was the big gangster in Tampa, and so then the mafia took it over. And you had two main dons who were running things in Florida, Santo Traficante Jr. in Tampa, and then over in the Miami area, it was Meyer Lansky. Mm. There's a story about Lansky that I just love, shows how smart he was. Some good government types in Hallandale got a court injunction against a popular gambling house that Lansky owned there, and called The Farm. And so the judge ruled you couldn't have gambling on this piece of property anymore. And so Lansky looked at the order and then issued some orders of his own. And so workmen came out, dismantled the whole thing,
tore
it completely down, and moved it to a piece of property adjacent to it, and built the whole thing an exact replica. And they called it a different name, and it opened up for business and ran, and that nobody could say anything about it.
He was no longer in violation of the law.
He was no longer in violation of the law. And Lansky and Traficante were the guys who ran the casinos in Cuba also. Mm-hmm. So if you're familiar story from Godfather 2, yeah. Hyman Roth is clearly based on Meyer Lansky.
So we've talked about kind of the unusual characters here in Florida. What is it about Florida that you think attracts them? Do we attract more than any other state?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we attract more people than any other state. I mean, we were the least populated southern state in 1940, and now we're the third most populous state. So we've had this huge human tsunami that's come in here. We passed New York in 2014, and so we've now got 20 million people living here. And then on top of that, we've got 100 million tourists coming in every year. And they're not evenly spread over the whole state. They're kind of crammed into this 30-mile-wide swath along the coast or along I-4. So, you know, you put that many people together in that many different places, coming from that many different backgrounds, speaking that many different languages, yeah, they're going to start ramming into each other's cars and chasing each other with machetes and arguing over whose dog pooped on whose lawn. But that's part of what makes Florida so much fun is, you know, every day, you know, if you want to open the paper every day and see the same stories day after day, go live in one of those square states out west like Nebraska. If you want to read the paper every day or turn on the news and say, wow, a guy punched a swan today, you're in the right place.
Today you tell me that you covered a story about an unusual shoplifter.
Yes, I saw a little item from the Villages, and I was intrigued by it, and so I had more questions than I had answers. So I contacted the police department and said, can I see the police report? And it still didn't answer my question. So I called up the person who got arrested, and I said, ma'am, when you were arrested for shoplifting, why were you wearing a turkey suit? And she had a perfectly logical explanation. So,
which was?
She likes to dress up as a turkey and give candy out to the kids.
And she was shoplifting.
And she's accused of shoplifting. She says she was not doing that. She plans to fight the charge. And she thought about going to court in the turkey outfit, but decided that would not be a smart idea. Because apparently the judge would think she was stuffing something else in the turkey.
One of the stories you tell in your book is John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club. He was walking across Florida and got the Cedar Key, and it had a big impact on him.
Yes,
what happened?
Absolutely. He was doing his 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf. He covered this vast amount of area across the country, and he gets down to Florida, and all the way before he got here, he was forging his own path through the woods. He gets to Florida, and it's just too thick. He can't get through, so he has to walk along the railroad tracks. And the other thing on his mind is he's a little concerned about alligators. He's a little nervous about those. So he manages to make it from Fernandina Beach to Cedar Key, and from there he planned to take a boat to Cuba, except a mosquito bit him, and he fell ill with malaria. And he passed out, and a kind Florida resident saved him, basically nursed him back to health. But
this is before we have antibiotics or anything to treat malaria.
Yes, he could have died. So, but while he's convalescing, it forces him to stop and think about man's place in the universe. Up to this point, the common belief was everything in nature is intended for man's use. And he realized that that's not true. He came to this epiphany that there are things in nature that are hostile to man, like alligators and mosquitoes that carry malaria, and that maybe those things have a place in nature that's apart from man, and maybe they have a role and a purpose that is important for nature. And that's sort of the foundation of the whole environmental movement in America, all because of one Florida mosquito biting John Muir in Cedar Key.
We like to
Why there's not a statue of that mosquito in Cedar Key, I don't know.
We like to reject the rules here in Florida. No motorcycle helmets. Miami, for a time, had that slogan, the rules are different
not
here.
Not just Miami. That was the Florida tourism
that
slogan.
That was the whole state of Florida.
Yes.
We dismissed rules. We don't like to be told what to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's us. I mean, I wrote the book about manatees, and one of the big arguments in there is, in terms of manatee protection, is why don't we require boaters to have licenses the way we require drivers to have licenses? And the argument basically boils down to freedom. Freedom. It's the last thing we don't regulate is people driving boats really fast, and we don't require them to know anything about a boat before they get in it and turn on the switch. They just have to own it. And so the argument is, we should let that last bit of freedom be free. And that's why we let people go out, and that's why we often have the largest number of boating accidents in America.
Well, speaking of freedom, Walt Disney had an idea for a city of the future, and this takes up quite a lot of your book. He came down here secretly, quietly, in the early 1960s to plan something new.
On a very special date, it was November 22nd, 1963, he gets on board a plane.
Kennedy's assassination.
Yes, yeah. he and some colleagues get on board a plane loaned to him by Arthur Godfrey, the ukulele-playing TV entertainer, and they flew over Central Florida. They'd been looking for a place for an East Coast theme park. A counterpart to Disneyland, and they find this spot that Walt says is absolutely perfect because he can see where the Florida Turnpike and I-4 are going to cross right there. And it's vast swampland, basically. And so he says, that's it, that's the right place. And then they land and they see everybody crying and they don't know why, so they ask why and discover it's Kennedy's assassination. But he was bored with the idea of building a second theme park. He knew he needed to do it economically. What he really wanted to do was build his experimental prototype city of the future, which would be this place where all of the latest technology would be on display. People would live the way people were supposed to live in the future. It would show the way for the rest of the world on how they should change their lives. And then he died.
He was a chain smoker.
He was a chain smoker, and he had cancer, and he died.
He dies in 66?
Yeah, and so suddenly the job of making this happen falls on the shoulders of his older brother, Roy, who had been planning to retire. Well, Roy was a bottom-line guy. Roy was not a dreamer like Walt. He wasn't a visionary. He was a guy who said, we have to make money. Walt's dead. If we don't do something, this whole corporation's going to collapse in our ears. Let's build the theme park, and maybe we'll get to that experimental prototype city sometime down the road. But they used that as a way to get the legislature to bend to their will, to give them everything they wanted. I mean, basically, they got the right to run themselves as their own government. It's the Reedy Creek Improvement District. They have the right to build just about anything they want to out there, including a nuclear reactor, and pass their own taxes and do everything else.
And an international airport,
yes,
if they want.
If they want. And they did all kinds of things to the landscape that you probably wouldn't be allowed to do.
Walt didn't like the color of the water that he flew over. What did he say about the color of the water?
He didn't like that brown color that we all regard as wonderfully natural. He wanted it to be blue, like the color in his imagination. And he had hired people from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers who said, if you spend enough money, we can make it whatever color you want. And they did.
He gets a group of ex-CIA people to buy up twice as much land as the size of Manhattan.
Yes. Well, not they weren't all from the CIA, but the main guy was an attorney in Miami who had worked with the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor of the CIA. And he had worked with the CIA on the Bay of Pigs invasion. He had worked with drug smugglers on their banking issues. And he had connections with the mafia. And then he went to work for Uncle Walt, so you know, that's the nice bit of Florida cognitive dissonance there with that, that connection. But yeah, Walt didn't want people to know he's buying the land, because then that would drive the price up. So they went in under a variety of false names and bought up the land. And a nice little touch: if you go to Disneyland and go to Main Street, Disney World, Main Street USA, and you walk down the street, you can see the names of those phony corporations on the businesses on Main Street in Disney World today.
Wow. I want to ask you about the springs here in Florida as we wrap up the show, because as an environmental reporter, you've covered the springs.
Yes.
We have incredible natural beauty here,
but it's
quite endangered here in the state of Florida.
We have the most first magnitude springs in the world. It's one of the great glories of Florida. It was one of our first tourist attractions. In fact, a lot of people came down to Florida to take the cure, you know, by soaking in our natural springs. In fact, William Bartram's accounts of the springs inspired Samuel Taylor Coleridge's famous poem about Kublai Khan. Our springs, many of them owned by the taxpayers, are part of the state park system, and they are suffering from pollution, from stormwater runoff filled with nitrogen that's causing widespread algae blooms that tend to be toxic, and also a loss of flow caused by overpumping of the aquifer in order to water our lawns and keep them green. So there was an effort under Governor Jeb Bush to try and fix that, to set up individual springs councils that would recommend ways to rescue those springs. There was money set aside. They did a lot of work on it, and then when Governor Scott came in, the interest in cost-cutting took precedence, and they shut them all down. And then there was a series of stories, some of which I wrote, that suddenly got the governor's attention, and he has started spending a lot of money on saving the springs, but springs advocates say it's not being spent wisely or well, and they are very critical of that.
If you were to go back 100 years and look at the beauty of the springs and the number of springs that people were using for recreation, or at least available, mm-hmm. Are there springs now that no longer flow that would have flowed 100 years ago?
Yes, absolutely.
Give us an example.
One is the most prominent one is Kissingen Springs over in Polk County, which was a popular community meeting spot. People would go there for, you know, church dinner on the grounds and that kind of thing. And in the 1940s, it dried up completely because of phosphate mining. The phosphate miners were using tremendous amounts of water from the aquifer. That industry as a whole has cut back on their water use now, but since that time, residential development has moved into that area, and so you'd have to cut back 80% of their water use if you were going to get even a trickle out of Kissingen now.
And there are a lot of springs like that that have dried up?
I wouldn't say a lot, but there are quite a few prominent ones. I did a series in, I think it was 2012, about Florida Springs, and one place I went to was a church camp that had been specifically built because they had a beautiful natural spring right at the center, and that became the centerpiece of the whole camp. And then because of the development around it pumping the aquifer dry, the spring stopped flowing and it became stagnant. And actually, the health department came in and said, you can't swim in there anymore. Mm-hmm. And so they had to spend more than $1 million to build a fancy pool aquatic center type thing in order to keep the camp going. But they lost their spring. It didn't flow anymore.
And at the same time, pollution, both above ground and then underground pollution is hurting us too. What's the single biggest thing that the state could do to try to restore some of the springs to their natural beauty? Like Silver Springs is terribly in danger, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's basically what happens around in the area they call the spring shed, where there are activities there that are funneling pollution into it. And those individual Springs councils that were set up under Governor Bush actually had some answers. They were buying some land. They were encouraging the state to buy some land to keep it from being developed, or making agreements with landowners to change the way they spread fertilizer on their land, things like that, in order to stop the flow of that pollution. In the case of Wakulla Springs, it was suffering because Tallahassee had a spray field for their sewage plant that was basically spraying sewage into the aquifer that flowed into Wakulla Springs. So they were able to stop that. And so an attention to individual cases is really important. And so they're trying to work on that now. But like I said, in the meantime, they're continuing to allow more development, more pressure on the aquifer, more pumping, those kind of things. And so it's almost like, here, we're going to save the spring. No, we're not. You know, here, let me help you with my right hand and mess you up with my left.
Well, Craig, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for
my
your
pleasure.
Environmental reporting, and thanks for the entertaining stories in Old Florida. What a
sure.
great book.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for watching Florida This Week.
That was an interview with Craig Pittman, a reporter at the Tampa Bay Times, about his new book, Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. The book just came out this year. And if you want to comment about that interview, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. And we're going to open up the phone lines for the last part of this program. You're listening to Radioactivity on 88.5 FM. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Something interesting happened overnight, and I just want to mention it as we launch into the phone calls. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Overnight, CNN reported this. They reported that President Donald Trump could be on track to spend as much as triple the time former President Barack Obama did on the golf course in his first year in office, and to play more than former President George W. Bush did in 8 years in office. Trump spent Saturday at his Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, marking the 81st day that the president has visited one of his golf courses and his fourth straight day at a golf club. A law enforcement source said Trump played with golf legend Jack Nicklaus, a longtime supporter of President Trump. It's unclear, however, whether Trump golfs every time he visits a course or how many rounds he plays when he does. White House aides rarely confirm that the president is golfing, but Trump did so himself on Friday, announcing that he was playing with golf stars Tiger Woods and Dustin Johnson. By comparison, Obama played 333 rounds of golf during his 8 years in office, and at this point in the first year of his term had played 26 rounds of golf, according to CBS News, who keeps detailed statistics on presidencies, Mark Noller of CBS News. Noller told CNN that Bush played only 24 rounds of golf as president and stopped playing golf after October 13, 2003, after Bush was criticized for golfing while the nation was at war. At this point in his presidency, Bush had golfed 7 times. So President Trump could be on track to spend as much as triple the time that former President Obama did on the golf course in his first year in office, and to play more than former President George W. Bush did in 8 years in office. So far, thinking is that President Obama may have golfed 81 times during first year in office. And President Obama played a total of 333 rounds of golf during his 8 years in office. So anyway, that's a story that came out. So I want to say then that after that story broke on CNN, and it's been discussed, it was discussed on TV on CNN over the weekend, President Trump came out this morning and said this. He said, let's have a contest and over which network wins the fake news trophy. All right, so the president is tweeting this morning after this report comes out about his high level of golf activity. President Trump says this. President Trump pitched a new reality TV concept on Twitter this morning, claiming he is everyone's favorite president. Trump suggested holding a contest to see which news network is the most dishonest, corrupt, and/or distorted in its coverage of your favorite president, me. He made sure to indicate that the contest would definitely include CNN, but definitely would not include Fox News, and the winner would receive a prize of a fake news trophy. So the president wants to give away a prize for which network carries the most fake news, but he's specifically saying Fox News will not be included in the consideration. So what do you think about that? 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Back in 2014, PolitiFact looked at fake news and false news on the major networks, and this is what it discovered. It discovered that 45% of the claims that PolitiFact has checked from NBC and MSNBC pundits and on-air personalities have been rated mostly false, false, or pants on fire. 45% rating for NBC and MSNBC. At Fox, they got a 58% rating for mostly false, false, or pants on fire. CNN got a 22% rating. 22% of things mentioned on CNN that were fact-checked by PolitiFact rated mostly false, false, or pants on fire. So at least in that rating in 2014, Fox came out the worst. Now, ABC, let's see. All right, so I don't have a rating for ABC, and I don't have a rating for CBS from this PolitiFact article. I'll try to find out, try to read more about that. So here's the number to call, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. So Andrew writes this, great show, but please advise your guests that the Trafficante pronunciation of the name Trafficant is wrong and has been spread intentionally by law enforcement as a way of insulting the family. The final T is silent or nearly so, and correct pronunciation is quite nuanced. Any member of the family will be happy to help him with it, and many of them have no connection to the family business, writes Andrew. Andrew, thanks for that. Andrew, if you could send us the correct pronunciation, is it Trafficant? Is that how you pronounce it? 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And Jeff Haynes and Frank Knox are our phone producers today. Let's go to Karen first in Tampa. Hey, Karen, what's on your mind today?
Hi, hey, Rob.
Hi, Karen, you're on. What would you like to say?
Well, that's the fastest I've ever gotten on. I have a question. It's a genuine question. While he is doing, you know, while Trump is doing all this nonsense that he's always doing, golfing and silly tweets, who is actually, who do we think is actually, like, running things? I mean, I don't think it's him. And I'm curious about who really, is it the vice president? Is it his chief of staff? Who is running the country?
That's a great question. I'm not there, so I don't know who's running the country. I've read a lot about the supposed infighting in the White House, but I've not read day to day who has their finger, let's say, on what the major decisions are. I suppose it is still President Trump. Do you have doubts? You don't think that his aides come to him and say, President Trump, we've got to solve this issue. What's your decision?
I think that there's somebody who, I think they pretend to do that, but I'm not sure that, you know what I mean? Or I think that they're like working kind of around him or manipulating him or, because it just doesn't, I don't know. That's why I thought you might have a theory or maybe, you know, You are more up on all
the news. A lot of people thought that it was Vice President Cheney when George W. Bush was in the White House, that a lot of the major decisions were made by Vice President Cheney. I haven't seen a really good description of the Bush White House. There was a great book written about Cheney that suggested that he was really the brains in the Bush White House. But I haven't really seen a good book of behind the scenes, you know, actions saying that Cheney was the actual president. But I think it's entirely possible, you know, that it could be the chief of staff in the White House. It could be Pence. The frightening thing to me is that President Trump only seems to get his information from Fox News.
That's very scary. Well, the frightening thing to me is that I am actually happy at the thought that it's not him. Pence is a nightmare, but you know what I mean? Or like, I feel like anybody has got to be better. Or like, even if it's like one of the generals or something. So I'm actually at the point in my life where I would feel like some kind of a military coup, if the generals are running something, would actually be better. That's how bad it is, which is really frightening.
Wow, that is frightening. Karen, thanks a lot. Maybe our listeners have an idea about it.
Okay.
813-239-9663. I mean, the reason why I'm worried about Fox News is not so much that it has a conservative slant, but that it has a narrow focus. And so when I'm watching PBS and when I'm watching MSNBC and CNN and when I'm watching the local news channels here in the Tampa Bay area, and I'm watching C-SPAN, and, you know, probably everything that you watch, too. You probably watch a lot if you've got some time on the couch. You know, you get a pretty wide view of the world. I watch the BBC, and you know, I get reports from the International Al Jazeera Network. You know, the stuff that you probably watch too. And then, you know, then I make up my own mind. But I don't know if the president, in terms of what he reads or in terms of what he watches on TV, is that well-rounded. And not that I'm, you know, perfectly well-rounded, because there's certainly blind spots that I have. But I try to take in a lot. I watch Fox. I'm always surprised what Fox doesn't tell me, you know, and I want to call up the host and say, wait a minute, you didn't add this important detail to your story or to your conversation there on the panel. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, email address, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Elizabeth in Riverview. Hi, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Good morning, sir. With regard to President Tweet's golfing, let's hope it continues. Now, maybe he will be hit on the head with a golf ball with enough strength to maybe give him some common sense.
That is an awful thought.
No. It may knock some sense into his head. It can't make him any worse, for goodness sakes. We all must admit that. Anyway, what I really called about was the gentleman speaking about springs and all of that. Over there in Pinellas, they've been having trouble with their sewage, so they put in a very deep injection well, which puts now semi-treated sewage, I guess, into the aquifer. They have used the phrase, they're putting it into an isolated aquifer. No such thing, honey child. There is no isolated aquifer. There is a deep aquifer that they don't reach in their pumpage for municipal use and everything. And way down deep, there is this other, what's referred to as the very deep aquifer, that is not usable anyway because it's very salty. But the only separation is the fact that one water floats upon the other, I have been told. I'm not a hydrologist, but lots of people who have PhDs and all of this explained that to me many years ago. So?
Yeah, well, that's certainly a controversy over in St. Pete. You know, I think the bigger impact, though, on the springs is, one, overpumping, two, the septic tanks that are built too close to the springs, three is the runoff from both farms and from lawns. I can tell you that
everything.
I've gone down a lot of Florida springs, and it horrifies me to see perfect St. Augustine grass on houses that are built along the
right next to it,
right next to the springs,
you
know, one time I saw a guy admit he had a beautiful house, a $1 million house near one of the springs, and his house was up on a hill, flowing down into the springs, and he was administering pesticides to the weeds in the crack in his driveway. And I thought, you know, here you got this beautiful house, sir. And I wanted to go up and say, stop that. But, you know, I'm not that kind of guy.
But it's the
septic tanks that we don't have proper sewage systems along the springs. We should take care of that problem. We should take care of the runoff from farms and houses. Deep injection wells are a problem, but I think what's really hurting the springs is what goes on day to day, not those unusual events in St. Pete.
And nobody pays any attention to or won't change their habits.
Yeah, and certainly we're not getting much help from Tallahassee. As Craig said, at least Governor Bush took some steps, but now I think we've gone backwards. So.
Oh, yeah.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
See ya, sir.
All right, great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. I talked about President Trump saying, let's have a contest over which network wins the fake news category. He specifically, though, excluded Fox News, but I wonder, is that payback for the CNN reporting on his extravagant golf outings? What do you think? 813-239-9663, because he does want to include CNN as a possible winner in the fake news trophy contest. Let's go back to the phones. We're going to go to, we'll go to Tina in Tampa, and then we'll go to Russell in Tampa. Hey, Tina, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. What's
up?
You
know, I'd like to know three things. First, I'd like to know how much money is being spent on Secret Service protection for the Trump family. You know, remember early on when they did some reporting that the Secret Service was over budget with all the overtime, you know, costs for protecting all the Trumps that were on the payroll. There's, you know, the president, of course, and then his daughter, his son-in-law, and Donald Jr. I guess they still are, or maybe, I don't know, but we don't hear about that anymore.
Tina, you do. To be fair, you want the president's family to be protected, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. But I think that we also have to be within reason. I mean, he's put his entire family is on the payroll. I mean, is that really necessary? I mean, come on, what does Jared Kushner do? I mean, other than organize, you know, meetings with Russian operatives. What does Donald Trump Jr. do? And Ivanka Trump, for that matter.
This is what the Washington Post reported in August. They said the Secret Service said Monday it has enough money to cover the cost of protecting President Trump and his family through the end of September. But after that, the agency will hit a federally mandated cap on salaries and overtime unless Congress intervenes. The Post went on to report that if lawmakers don't lift the cap, about a third of the agency's agents would be working overtime without being paid, agency officials said. The Secret Service estimates that roughly 1,100 employees will work overtime hours in excess of statutory pay caps during the calendar year of 2017. The director of the Secret Service, Randolph Tex Alice, said in a statement, to remedy this ongoing and serious problem, the agency has worked closely with the Department of Homeland Security, the administration, and Congress over the past several months. So I think... he does have an extended family. They do get, one of the family members dropped his Secret Service protection, and I'm having a hard time remembering who that was. But the president does travel a lot to Mar-a-Lago and then his clubs in New Jersey and elsewhere.
Weekend he's gone.
Yeah, that's
every
added
weekend.
Cost to taxpayers, yeah.
Yeah, but we need someone to follow up on that, to what happened, because it's well past the end of September. And then the second thing I'd like to know is just why exclude Fox? I mean, if you want to do a review on these...
Well, isn't it obvious that the president has no problem with Fox or its large number of inaccuracies? I mean, that's the problem. Well, is that he's getting his news from a source that really is more politically motivated than it is... it doesn't really have a news tradition. It's not won a lot of journalism prizes.
Yeah, Fox is entertainment.
It's more than entertainment. It's an arm. It was founded by Roger Ailes to be an arm of the Republican Party.
Republican Party, yes, so true. But you know, to me, him saying that, exclude Fox News, that is just showing his President Trump's slant on things. I think that shows that he really doesn't want an honest assessment. He just wants to, you know, he wants to protect his pals at Fox News and come up with, you know, this is the thing that about him that gets me. He just shoots from the hip. Anytime anybody asks him a question that he doesn't want to answer, you're fake news, or that's fake news. He does that all the time. So maybe something like this, an assessment, accurate and honest by an objective party, and like you cited a couple of them, they're all accurate reports of news. CNN, CBS, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. They're conservative. They're all accurate. They all do a pretty good job. But you know, President Trump uses his fake news thing as a way to what's the word? It's like a
shield. You can't question him once he calls it fake news. Tina, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Great to hear from you. You know, I don't think that CNN or MSNBC or the New York Times are perfect, but I think that at least in terms of covering the wide range of stories that we need to know about, they do that, and they have a pretty good track record of being fair and honest. Now, there are some times where I think the mainstream media has really fallen asleep. One is the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, where none of what the Bush administration was telling us turned out to be true. And so, yeah, there were mistakes, have been mistakes, and I think we should point those out. But I think if we went and watched Fox News and see what it omitted day to day and what it didn't cover and how it covered things, I think we'd find out more falsehoods on Fox than we would on any of the other mainstream networks. Let's go to Russell in Tampa. Hey, Russell, you're on. Thanks a lot for calling. What's up?
Hey, Rob, nobody's really surprised that the media has a bias, are they?
Well, I think the media has a bias a lot of different ways. One is that I think it's biased towards power and the establishment in Washington, D.C., but what really bothers me is Fox being so biased and so pro-Republican that you can't really watch it and look for news on Fox. You can see criticisms of liberals on MSNBC. They went after Harvey Weinstein and they went after John Conyers and others pretty hard on CNN and MSNBC. But Fox, if any of their Republican, the people that they love on the Republican Party do something evil, Fox will barely mention it. So, Russell, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call.
Hi, Rob.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, what you just said is not factually correct.
Okay. Tell me why.
And people do data-driven studies of what these networks cover and how they cover it, and what you said is just not supported by the data.
Well, I was quoting PolitiFact. What would you quote? Give us a data-driven survey that you rely on that says that Fox is factual. Just tell us where we can find that study.
Rob, you're making a blanket statement.
No, Russell, just tell us, where what Fox reports is factual or has a better job of reporting the facts than does the New York Times and CNN.
About the facts.
All right, well, just tell us where we can find this report that says that Fox does a better job in reporting the facts than does the New York Times or CNN or MSNBC.
Will you let me make my point?
I'm trying to.
All right. You can be factually correct and it's still propaganda.
Well, tell us, Russell, you're dancing around this. And let me give you one more chance. I cited a report in PolitiFact that said that the least factual network was Fox News. So if you've got a data-driven report that shows that Fox News is the most factual network, tell us what the source is. I gave you a report. I'll email it to you, too. It's a 2014 report from PolitiFact. You tell me where there's a factual study of Fox News where it comes out on top.
Making that case.
All right, so you just said that. That's how you opened up. You opened up by saying that there is a that Fox News is factual.
Liberal bias.
Okay, so
acknowledge that.
I'm sorry?
Do you have a liberal bias?
No. I've got a bias towards social justice and human rights and peace and equality, which is the mission of MNF.
Are you telling me that WMNF does not lean left?
I'm saying that we have a bias towards peace, social justice, equality, human rights, and the environment. That's what we stand for. That's always been what MNF stands for. We safeguard those things. So when some liberals started to say that the war in Iraq was a good idea, we pointed out that they were wrong. Okay?
Well, why don't you just admit that you're...
Russell, you don't have the study. You're dancing around. You're wasting time. We've got every other line lit, and people can't get in because you're dancing around. Russell, next time, if you say you've got a study, tell us where that study can be found, okay? Russell, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. Russell, thanks. I'm sorry we ran out of time, but there's another call-in show coming up, so stick around for Sean Canaan. He'll be hosting the Midpoint program next. And if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the news. This is WM.